Hello, this is Home Baking. This is a podcast about adventures in home baking through ingredients, history, and culture. Today, we're going to be talking about syrup semolina cakes. They go by many different names. You might have heard of basbousa, harissa, namora, shamali, revani, pastusha, kaloprama, hilba, and many more. And so we'll be talking a little bit about those types of cakes. We're going to be talking about two that I made. I made hilba and I made a coconut semolina cake as well. And then we'll be talking as well, at the start of the episode, we'll be talking a little bit about the foods of the Ottoman Empire. These syrup cakes seem to have in common is that they are prevalent throughout the lands that were once ruled or occupied by the Ottoman Empire. And as if that wasn't enough, we're going to be talking about a craggly, delicious walnut and vanilla cake, which I'm kind of putting under syrup cakes because I serve it with some type of syrup, but it's quite different from the other two cakes. So, let's get started. Thank you so much for listening in. And just as a reminder, if you want to read the show notes or get the recipes, you can just go to homebaking.substack.com, where I would encourage you strongly to sign up. It's free to get those in your inbox, which is also it might act as a little reminder that you can listen to the new episode because I release them at the same time. So let's talk about syrup cakes. As I say, they come in with many different names, often spelt differently as well, because most of the countries that they are eaten in don't have the alphabet that is used in English and various European languages. According to Wikipedia, these syrup cakes originate from Egypt, but I looked at the sources, because that's what you should do if you're wanting to be a good food historian. And the sources that were cited were a blog post and a recipe. So not quite the kind of tight historical accuracy that I had hoped for there. So I think that with many, many things in food history, the actual origins are likely unprovable. But what you do see is how food spreads and influences spread, and some of that history is tied up with empire. What these particular cakes seem to have in common, they're usually made with semolina, which is like it's made with wheat. It's a flour, but it's much coarser than all-purpose flour, for example. And they're also soaked in a syrup once they come out of the oven. That's what they have in common. Common kind of flavourings are things like rose water, orange blossom, pistachio, some sort of clotted cream type of thing like ashta, I said pistachio and rose water, walnuts as well, that's quite common. There's lots of different flavorings. Citrus is also very common, and as I say, the thing that they seem to have in common is that they're popular throughout countries that where some of the country part of the country that exists today, or maybe even all of it, at one time was ruled or occupied by the Ottoman Empire. So I thought it might be interesting to talk about food in the Ottoman Empire, but In order to kind of get a sense of the Ottoman Empire itself a bit more, I had to start with doing some research about the basics, to just have a little bit of background knowledge. So I didn't study it at school at all. I think that the history education that I got was like very like Western Europe centric, and it was an incredibly important political actor, there's a lot of very wide reaching historical consequences of it, but it just simply was not on the curriculum. The only time it was mentioned was when we were talking about World War One, because it was a significant actor in World War One. But that was literally it. But what I'd imagine, I don't know, because I didn't grow up there, but I'd love to hear from people if this applies to any of you. I might try and talk to my Bulgarian neighbour as well, and Turkish friends and stuff. But I'd imagine that if you live in the Balkans or North Africa, parts of North Africa or the Eastern Mediterranean, you probably studied it a bit more than I did. So forgive me, you know, if you want to skip the next few minutes, that's fine. I'm just going to go through a few basics for those of us who didn't get any education whatsoever about the Ottoman Empire. So first of all, it spanned 7 centuries. It was founded at the end of the 13th century and collapsed in the early 20th century. It reached the peak of its power in the 17th century under Suleiman I, during which time it had 32 provinces. And this kind of blew my mind. It had control or partial control of lands that are today part of the modern countries of Turkey, Sudan, Egypt, Yemen, Bulgaria, Albania, Macedonia, Montenegro, Kosovo, Greece, Cyprus, Moldova, Bosnia, Ukraine, Georgia, Serbia, Russia, Azerbaijan, Hungary, Romania, Armenia, Jordan, Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Tunisia, Algeria, Libya, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. Right, if I missed any, let me know. You can email me flourbuttereggssugar@gmail.com. What an enormous list. Now, it's important to note that for some of those, it was quite a tiny strip of land. So it really only had control of quite a small strip of land on the Arab Peninsula, for example. But for others, it was quite a large part, if not the whole country. So it had enormous reach and influence. Really significant. The other thing that I kind of vaguely remember this being brought up at school once, and I think it was in the context of the First World War, but slavery was a significant part of the economy of the Ottoman Empire for hundreds and hundreds of years, and it existed right up until the early 20th century. In the earlier part of it, people were captured from Slavic countries, particularly what are now the modern countries of Poland and Lithuania and parts of Russia, the kind of Eurasian steppe. Also, especially later on, East and Central Africa. And that was because of rules about not enslaving, and religious beliefs about not enslaving other people of the book. So Muslims, obviously, but also the other people of the book who are Jews and Christians. So if lots of people have converted to Christianity in Europe, you can't then enslave them, which is partly why they sought to enslave people from other countries. And the Ottoman Empire also traded a lot of enslaved people who had been captured by other groups, particularly Barbary pirates, who raided coastal towns all over Europe, including in like southwest England, like Cornwall and Devon, but also Italian fishing villages, and more so the Eastern Mediterranean. It blows my mind to think that there might be people today whose ancestors were captured from like Cornwall and enslaved. Just because I think we don't think about, I don't know, like the that, and to be fair, there weren't very many Western European enslaved people. That's why we don't think about it. You know, it's nowhere near on the same scale as the transatlantic slave trade, or indeed even capturing people from the Eurasian steppe and Slavic countries. But it did, it was a thing. It did happen. So traditionally, the Turkic peoples, which is a really vast and like load of different ethnic groups, which goes right up into China, and includes like the Uyghur people, for example, whose food is quite. Has quite a lot in common with Turkish food. But Turkic people were traditionally nomadic, and it's hard to know how true this is. Again, nothing's really written down very much until much later on, but oral history would seem to suggest that people carried around milk in animal skins, and that that might be linked to the production of yogurts and fresh cheeses, which are really, really important in these cuisines, especially labneh, and especially things like halim or halloumi and feta and things like that, or things that are kind of close to that, so fresh cheeses. However, during the Ottoman Empire, arable crop production became extremely significant, and what you see all over the world where people settle down and start farming is that it that can lead to a surplus, which can lead to people having time to do other things than just farm. And so you might get more complex social structures, for better or worse, and also technological advancements as well. And my final fact about the Ottoman Empire is that this is probably the most famous event in it. So you've probably heard of the fall of Constantinople, modern day Istanbul, but under the Ottoman army, with the Ottoman army under Mehmed II, they blockaded Constantinople for 53 days, and the city fell to the Ottomans on the 29th of May 1453, marking the end of the Byzantine Empire. So I think really the significant thing is the capture of the city, but even more so than that is the fall of the Byzantine Empire and kind of the finality of that is linked to that particular event. But what about the food? This is a food podcast, so don't worry at all. I've got you. We're going to be talking about all sorts of foods. A lot of these are some of my favourite foods, and I think obviously that's because of living in I often call it a Turkish area, but, you know, increasingly there are people in my area from all over Southeastern Europe. There's a lot of Greek people who've actually been here just as long, but people are kind of moving around. This is what you get in London because of prices and things like that. But yeah, there's Greek people, Turkish people, Cypriots, obviously. It's probably predominantly more Cypriot than anything else, but of, you know, Turkish and Greek Cypriots. And then you've also got Kurdish people, Bulgarians, Serbians, Albanians. Yeah, there's people from all over Southeastern Europe. And also there's a few Polish people dotted here and there as well. So living in this area, I'm very, very lucky and spoilt. There's also quite a lot of Georgian people as well. And we've got a phenomenal Georgian restaurant, which I'm extremely happy about. So I've been really influenced by the area that I've lived in for about 10 years now. And so I think as a result, you know, a lot of these foods are some of my favourite foods. So significant foods during the Ottoman Empire, which a lot of these kind of, a lot of these still exist today in some form or another. There's one that doesn't, which I'll talk about. There's a reason why that one doesn't. It sounds disgusting. But yeah, breads were very important. Wheat is produced through a lot of Europe and Central Asia, all sorts of places. But obviously, with the Ottoman Empire being Muslim, I mean, there are Muslims that do drink alcohol sometimes, or in weak formats and things like that. It's not quite as clear cut as a lot of people would think. But yeah, there wasn't much beer production, potentially for religious reasons. But wheat was used in lots of other ways, you know, so pitta bread, pumpernickel bread, also bulgur wheat and couscous and things like that. Grapes are really important, so no wine. Wine is actually specifically prohibited in the Quran. That's what it says, that you shouldn't drink wine. So instead of making wine, you might use grapevine leaves, which obviously is what you use in dolma, you know, stuffed vine leaves, raisins, grape molasses, grape everything. And you can see the way that's persisted in dolmas and also pekmez, grape molasses, which is delicious. And I've talked about it before on this podcast. Soups and broths were really important and still are today. And they were kind of deemed healthy and a good way to start a meal, to prepare your stomach for the ensuing feast if you are rich. And often they contain a starch or are served with a starch like bulgur wheat or rice. My favourite Turkish restaurant in the whole of London, which that says a lot because I've visited many, many Turkish restaurants and I love them, but it is this small, pretty down-to-earth place called Haringey Jorbagisi. It's a soup and stew place. I absolutely love it. Unfortunately, it's currently being renovated. So it's currently closed and I'm very sad about that. I can't wait until it reopens. They have a yogurt soup, which is, I've never had anything like it before, and it is phenomenal. And apparently yogurt soup does date back to the Ottoman Empire. Like, it's been eaten for centuries. Pilafs. So pilafs are kind of like spiced or studded rice things, dishes, side dish. In this context, pilaf in South Asia is often a main dish with everything in it, including meat. But these types of pilafs tended to be more of a side dish. And as well as being made with rice of different kinds, you might have wild rice, black rice, brown rice, white rice. They're also made sometimes with bulgur wheat and other grains. Meats, so particularly lamb and mutton, were very important. Pork wasn't eaten due to religious restrictions, and cattle were kind of relied on more for milk production. So lamb and mutton are quite kind of common meats if you could afford to eat meat. Fish, lots of fish, any kind of fish that you could really catch in the Mediterranean, but anchovies were kind of the king of all of the fish, which I understand because I love them. Vegetable dishes, so the best of the vegetable dishes, in my opinion, are the aubergine ones, but there are some really good ones that use artichokes. I love artichokes. Purslane, which is purslane is a mild green leafy thing, not dissimilar to spinach, which is also really common. Purslane's actually even more delicate than spinach. And also bell peppers, and red pepper paste is really important in Turkish cuisine. It's often used to flavor bulgur wheat and rice and things. I keep some in my fridge and I put it on bread sometimes. And I use it I use it to make sauces with, a bit like you might use like tomato puree or something like that. That's how I use it. And they have red pepper paste throughout like Southeast Europe. It's really, really important in Bulgarian food as well. But anyway, going back to these vegetable dishes. So some of these are served cold. So imam bayaldi is this like really rich, oily aubergine dish that you eat usually cold. And also shakshuka, the Turkish kind. So you can get, so the North African shakshuka is a bit different. It tends to be hot. It's more saucy. Whereas the Turkish shakshukas that I've had, and menemen, which are quite similar, or sometimes the same, they're like a vegetable dish that's made with tomatoes are kind of the main thing that you need to have. But there's often peppers, sometimes aubergine. Those are you, and shakshuka is usually served cold in Turkish restaurants, in my experience. And it's something that you might like dip bread into and things like that. Delicious. I love it. There's also savory pastries. So lots of different types of things called börek, which essentially is just savory pastry things that have got stuffing in of some kind. You know, it might be lamb, it might be cheese, might be potato, when potatoes were available, aubergine. My favorite is either aubergine and salty cheese, or potato geschlemme, which I just love, even though it's so like heavy and stodgy. That's kind of why I like it. But yeah, lots of different types of stuffed pastries and boreks. One of the best, I think, is sigara beregi, which I'm saying incorrectly probably, but it's like thin cigarette type things of pastry that are wrapped around a salty cheese and spinach filling and then deep fried. And they are crunchy, they are salty, they've got like the kind of bitterness of the spinach. They're basically like the perfect like snack to have with a beer. But they're often served as a starter as well in modern Turkish restaurants. Okay, there's also baklava, obviously, of course there is, which is an oven-baked thing, usually filled layers of yufka pastry, which is like similar to filo, usually stuffed with some sort of nut, and but not always, sometimes there's other stuffings as well, soaked in syrup and or honey. Or a syrup made with honey, maybe, and often flavoured with rose water. That's that type of syrup as well, but not always. I thought that maybe my favourite dessert, which is künefe, might be related, also have something to do with the Ottoman Empire, but actually, it comes from the Fatimid Caliphate, not the Ottoman Empire. That was interesting. But it is very, very popular throughout the Middle East these days, and including in Turkey. Okay, there's also milky desserts. So baked custards, rice puddings, rice flour thickened milk things, which are often now called muhlebiye, and other names that are kind of similar. There was even a milk dessert that contained shredded chicken breast that was called tavuk goju. It sounds foul. It was like a kind of like wobbly white thing that had shredded chicken breast, and it was a kind of delicacy of rich people. It honestly sounds foul. So I can see why that one hasn't survived. There were also obviously as well, it was, yeah, so as I said, it was a dessert, it was sweet, so it was a sweet milky dessert that had chicken breast. I'm not sure about that. Yeah, as I said, I think there's a reason that that does not survive to this day. There were also fruity desserts and drinks, so ashura, which is sometimes called Noah's pudding, which is common in lots of different cuisines, is common in Sephardi Jewish cuisine as well, and it's a kind of pudding made of, or dessert kind of, made of grains, fresh fruit, dried fruit, and nuts. Sometimes it's called or thought to be the oldest dessert in the world, because it's said to have been eaten by Noah, or even by Adam and Eve. And in terms of fruity desserts and drinks, Shabbat is also quite important. Now, there are different types of Shabbat in different countries. This one is a kind of mixed fruity drink, often with added sugar and sometimes added water, depending on the strength of the fruit. And that's like a thin, refreshing drink. Whereas Persian Shabbat is really quite different. It's like a thick thing that you can like stand a spoon in. There's also halva. This is a really, really different type of halva from sesame halva, which I'm always banging on about because I love sesame halva. But this is the type of halva which you get in many countries, which is a flour or semolina cooked with sugar, milk, cream and or fat, which then is sort of set and is sliced, is actually much more similar to Indian subcontinent mithai sweets than it is to sesame halva. There's also celep, celep comes from wild orchids, from their tubers, a particular kind of orchid as well, I believe, which the tubers are turned into a flower, which can then be used to thicken things and give it an interesting flavour. So it's usually served as a hot drink. I've got a packet of celep hot drink powder. It's kind of like the way that you might drink a Horlicks or something, or a hot chocolate. It's more of a winter drink, really. But celep is also used in bouza, which is a thickened ice cream. Okay, so two more things that I want to talk to you about in terms of important foods in the Ottoman Empire. So I found this really interesting. So coffee was really important. So because of Yemen being in the Ottoman Empire, at least for some of the time, it meant that coffee grown there, coffee originates in Ethiopia, which is not too far away, and it was taken over to Yemen and grown in Yemen, and then it could be drunk through the rest of the Ottoman Empire and also exported. So it was an important export of the empire. And coffee was so popular. Coffee houses were a really important place that you could meet men from all corners of society, including the lower classes, men of different social backgrounds mixed and gossiped, traded, shared news. It was actually really important in spreading capitalism. And also it was used to gather information and even politically organize. And some rulers became kind of suspicious of them, and even at times sent in spies to monitor them, sometimes tried to repress them through taxing them heavily. Sultan Murad IV actually banned them, but none of these actions had much effect on the popularity and usage of both coffee and the coffee house. Coffee or kahve across much of the Ottoman Empire was very thick and very strong, and it's made in the same way as coffee that you might the way that traditional coffee is made in Arab countries, in Greece. So you might know it by other names too, but it's very, very thick, very strong and bitter, traditionally made in copper pots called chesvas. Yes, and when I've had Turkish coffee in a Turkish place, I've had it served with water because it's so strong that you actually need to like hydrate yourself a bit, and also with some sort of Turkish delight type thing. The last one I had was mint. And what's crazy is, like, I don't like Turkish coffee. I don't know why I ordered Turkish coffee. I think I was trying to look cool. We went out for a Turkish breakfast, which is exceptionally good. I should have just ordered Italian style coffee because that's what I like. Turkish coffee is the one thing I don't really like about the cuisine. I just find it too strong. But I ordered one. I tried to drink it. I found it almost undrinkable. But I drank most of it. And then I had the mint Turkish delight that came with it, which I also didn't really like. So then I was like drinking loads of different drinks to try and get the taste out of my mouth. Yes. Anyway, Chronicles of a Silly White Lady. So the last one is related. As I say, it's often served with coffee. I'm going to call it Lumps of Delight. So it might go by Rahat or Hulkum, Locum, Lokma, many other names, but you likely know it as Turkish Delight or Greek Delight. But my favourite term, I didn't make this up, genuinely didn't make this up. For a while in England, it was called Lumps of Delight. It's sugary, starchy, served in small pieces. And common flavourings include rose water, bergamot, walnut and mastic. It even makes its way into some versions, quite common versions, of the Romanian celebration bread Cozonac. Yes, it's really travelled far and wide, and it's often served alongside coffee to counteract the bitterness. So that is everything that I've got to say on the Ottoman Empire and foods of the Ottoman Empire. Next up, we're going to talk about a few different syrup cakes, and we're going to kind of whiz through the recipes a little bit, not in a stressful way, just in a factual way. And yeah, then we're going to talk about a walnut cake that I made as well. Right, first up, we have got a delightful, very unusual Palestinian cake called hilba, which is made with fenugreek. And then we're going to talk about a coconut and semolina syrup cake, and then a craggly walnut cake. Right, before we get into the recipes, I've got three top baking tips for making syrup cakes. Number one. You need either cold syrup, hot cake, or hot cake. No, cold syrup, hot cake, or cold cake, hot syrup. If both are hot, it'll be dense and sludgy. If both are cold, the syrup will not sink in properly. One needs to be hot, the other needs to be cold. Got it? Okay. Number two, semolina seems to vary drastically in what counts as final course. But the good news is you can bake with a finer or coarser semolina than specified, but a coarse semolina will take longer to bake, and a fine semolina will take less time. Due to this, you might need to adjust your oven temperature for a lower, slower bake or for a faster, hotter bake. Also, if you have coarse semolina or you think your semolina is a bit too coarse, you can pulse it in the food processor to make it finer. It's really good to know, isn't it? Okay, number three, syrup cakes such as these first two are better the next day. So even with the coconut and semolina syrup cake, I was told that you could serve it after 2 hours. No, much better the next day. Much better the next day. The flavours had had a chance to mingle, the syrup had soaked in properly, so this is a good cake to make the day before a celebration. It's a bad cake to make for when you just want cake and you need it immediately. But it keeps fantastically well. You can keep it just on the side covered for a few days. It's great. And obviously, like, that's why it originates in hot countries. It's a good thing to be able to maintain its like moisture and stuff. Right, so that's our top three tips. Let's talk about Hilba or fenugreek cake. So this is a lovely complex floral cake from Palestine. It's a bit less sweet than many other syrup cakes, which do tend to be on the sweet side. I loved it. Just be aware that the almonds are just there to look pretty. They don't add much in terms of flavour, but they do look very nice. And fenugreek is more commonly known as a kind of earthy spice that you would have in a curry. And without boiling it, it's quite bitter. But if you boil it and then bake it, it really becomes mild and floral. So that was kind of a revelation to me. Now, I got this recipe mostly from one in Jerusalem by Yota Motolenghi and Sami Tamimi. I tweaked it here and there. The main change that I made was I didn't use yeast. Like, it's quite a complicated cake to make already without having to prove things. So I just used baking powder because I'm a modern woman. And I'm lazy. So let's get into the ingredients. So you want 500 grams of fine semolina, which is roughly about it's over 2 pounds. It's quite a lot. 75 grams of plain or all-purpose flour, 70 grams of ground pine nuts, or I just use ground almonds because I had some already. And they're cheaper. 80 milliliters, which is roughly 75 grams of olive oil. A kind of lighter olive oil is preferred to a very sort of bitter one. The same amount, 75 grams of a kind of neutral oil like grapeseed or sunflower. You can just use more olive oil if you've got a nice olive oil, why not? 40 grams of unsalted butter. You can definitely use a vegan replacement here with no issues because it's not that much compared to the rest of the recipe. A little bit of extra butter for greasing the pan. 1.5 teaspoons of fenugreek or meti seeds. That's just two names for the same thing. If you go to South Asian shops, they're often sold as meti, M-E-T-H-I. 4 teaspoons of baking powder, quite a lot, but that's due to the amount of semolina. 1/2 teaspoon of fine salt and 16 blanched, which is a type of skinless, whole almonds. Then for your syrup, because you might have noticed that there's currently no sugar in this recipe, so that would be quite a savoury tasting situation. For the syrup, you need 300 grams of sugar. I used castor, which, or superfine granulated would be just as good here, to be honest, because you're going to dissolve it anyway. 100 milliliters of water, 2 tablespoons of lemon juice, which is roughly 1 lemon, and then a bit of rose water and a bit of orange blossom. Now, the one that I had, I bought ages ago, the ones that I have, which are Steenbergs, and they've lasted me literally years because they are so strong that I only use quite a small amount at a time. So depending on what type of brand you've got and how strong it is, you might need less than a teaspoon. In my case, I needed less than a teaspoon of rose water. You might need a tablespoon or even a tablespoon and a half. It really just depends on the strength of rose water or orange blossom water that you have. Okay, so those are our ingredients. So to make this thing, there's a little bit of effort, more so than maybe most cake recipes that you might come across. So you've got to melt your butter, and then you've got to mix the semolina, flour, ground nuts, oils and butter together. Set it aside to give the semolina a chance to soak up the fat. Make the syrup next so that it has time to fully cool. So mix your sugar and water in a saucepan with a wooden spoon. Heat it up until it starts to boil, then add the lemon juice, simmer gently for 4 minutes. Take it off the heat, cool it a little, then add the rose and orange blossom waters. This is the next thing you've got to do. So put your fenugreek seeds in a saucepan with 600 milliliters or grams of water. Bring it to the boil and then simmer gently for 25 minutes. Meanwhile, preheat your oven to 200 degrees C, which is 400 Fahrenheit or 180 C fan. Grease and line an 8 by 13 inch tin, which is 20 by 33 centimeters. Drain the seeds from the fenugreek boiling mixture, but reserve the seeds and reserve the cooking water. Add the seeds to the semolina mixture, stirring them in so that there's seeds throughout. And then add 180 milliliters or grams of the fenugreek water. I had too much, as it happens, but if you don't have enough, add a little bit of plain water to make up 180 mil. Mix that in well, then sprinkle over the baking powder and salt and knead it in so that everything is evenly distributed. Press the mixture into the pan, level that out with the back of a spoon or an offset spatula, and then, very importantly, score the cake. Score it almost to the bottom. You don't want to cut the baking paper or the tin. Definitely score it, because if you try and score it after baking, it will not come out as nicely. What I did was I cut it into 8 squares, and then I cut each square into a triangle. Into 2 triangles to make 16 triangles. I'm not great at geometry, and that's what I could cope with, but if you want to go for more fancy design, feel free. But press an almond into the center of each piece. Then bake it for about 30 minutes, turning it around once for even baking, if your oven doesn't bake very evenly. When you take it out, it should have a kind of golden brown appearance. The time might vary depending on your oven, the pan you use, the type of semolina you use. So just use your own judgment to an extent, not just the timing. Once it's come out of the oven, pour over the cooled syrup slowly and evenly, and then leave it to fully cool, cover it, then serve it the next day. That's probably the most important instruction. Serve it the next day. Okay, so. Next up, we have got our coconut and semolina syrup cake. This is called harissa in the book that I took it from, but it's also often called basbousa, but it's just, which both just mean like some type of syrup cake, basically. A lot of the Jordanian versions apparently use coconut. This one happens to be vegan because a lot of syrup cakes don't actually use eggs if they're on the denser side. Like this one, and a lot of them use more oil than butter, so it's actually not that hard to veganize them. Sometimes they do use yogurt, sometimes they do use clotted cream, not as easy to veganize, but here we've used coconut yogurt, which just adds more deliciousness, more coconutiness. You do have to like coconut though, because this has got quite a lot of coconut in it. I like coconut, so I was good. And it's also got a lot of citrus in it as well, which really makes it very nice. You want 340 grams of castor or superfine sugar, but granulated would be fine too. Half a lemon, orange blossom water. Again, it depends on your type, but roughly a teaspoon to a tablespoon. Rose water, I used a scant teaspoon, but you might want to use a lot more. Depending on its strength, 125 milliliters or 120 grams of light olive oil or vegetable oil, a little bit of extra olive oil for greasing, 300 grams of what's called regular semolina. I interpreted that as fine because that's more common in the UK. That's what you get in the baking oil. That's what's used in our traditional semolina puddings. And then you want 50 grams of desiccated coconut, which is called dried, unsweetened, shredded. In some countries, it's a lot bit of a mouthful, isn't it? A half a tablespoon of baking powder, 200 grams of unsweetened coconut yogurt. I used a vegan dairy-free one, which was lovely, from Coconut Collective. And then you want some blanched or skinned whole almonds again to decorate the thing. You could, however, if you prefer, you could use something else to decorate or just leave it plain. So I used coconut flakes, but they were quite messy. So what I would do next time is, well, firstly, I would score the cake before I put it in the oven. That was a schoolboy error. Secondly, I would add the syrup first, and I would add the coconut flakes last, because it was a bit of a mess the way I did it. And you can see on the picture that it's a bit messy, but it tasted so damn good that I had to include it, and I will make it again at some point. I just haven't had time to do a second run recently. Okay, so in order to make this, you want to first make your syrup so that it can fully cool. You want 225 grams of sugar in a saucepan with 350 milliliters of water and the juice of a lemon half. Bring to the boil, then simmer it for 10 minutes. Stir in the orange blossom and rose water and set it aside. Preheat your oven to 200°C, 400 Fahrenheit, 180°C fan. Grease and line a 9x13 inch, 20x33 centimeter tin. Mix together the semolina, desiccated coconut, baking powder, and remaining 115 grams of sugar. You also, by the way, might want to add here like the zest of an orange. That's very nice. Then mix in the oil with a fork into the semolina so that you've got a nice even coating of oil on each grain. Mix in the coconut yogurt, make sure it's all even, then transfer that to the tin, score it into your desired shapes. Very important to do that before you put it in the oven though. Place an almond in the centre of each shape if you want. Then bake it for about 35 to 45 minutes. So in the original recipe, it says 40 to 45, but mine only took 35. So I was glad that I checked it early. You want a golden brown top. And once again, if your oven, like mine, bakes unevenly, turn it around halfway through. And then once your cake comes out of the oven, you want to slowly and evenly pour over the syrup. Leave it to cool completely, cover it. Guess what the last instruction is? Serve it the next day, the most important instruction. Okay, so that's the semolina cake. I took this to work and everyone couldn't stop eating it because I cut it up into really small slices, small pieces, because it is quite sweet. And also in case somebody didn't like it, they weren't wasting loads. But basically we all kept going back to it and having another small piece and another small piece and another small piece because it's quite Moorish. So it's very nice. That was a good endorsement of it, I thought. And I got this from Nystesima by Georgina Hayden, which I've mentioned before. I've also mentioned Jerusalem before. Both of them are great books. I love them. Jerusalem is not quite like, I don't know, I don't necessarily use Jerusalem in my everyday cooking. Some of the recipes are a bit complicated, but I definitely use it as a reference for a lot of things, and I do cook some of the salads. Nystesima, it's quite cookable for the most part. Some recipes are like just like a side dish, which I'm like, well, what do I serve that with, especially if it's in a kind of complicated one. But a lot of the recipes are highly cookable, especially the salads and the breads and the biscuits. So it is a good book. And it's really fascinating as well, because it's all about fasting foods around Orthodox countries. So we've sped through those really nicely, I hope. And now we're going to talk finally about my craggly walnut and vanilla cake. I was spending ages like working out what I wanted to do as my third cake. I knew I wanted to use walnuts because I like them and I miss them. I've not baked with them for a long time. Also, walnuts are really common throughout these areas like the Balkans and Middle East. But I didn't really like, I wasn't really that tempted by a lot of the recipes that I saw for whatever reason. So I kind of freestyled it. And this is one where you serve it with syrup rather than soaking the syrup into it. And it's a very low maintenance cake as well. So if the other two sound a bit complicated for your liking, trust me, this one's easy. I've based it on a tarta de Santiago, which is a cake from northern Spain that's made with ground almonds and eggs and sugar and really not much else. But I've used walnuts instead of almonds. I used vanilla instead of the traditional cinnamon and lemon zest that's used in a tarta de Santiago, which I do also love. The original is great as well, and it's equally good. And then I went even more rogue, and I chopped some of my extra walnuts, mixed them with vanilla and sugar, and put them on towards the end of baking time. And it's made like a crumble topping on the cake, which I really, really enjoy. Yeah, so that's why I've kind of chosen this cake. It's lower maintenance. Walnuts are very popular, even though this is not a traditional cake to these countries that I was talking about. Also, I thought you could serve it with one of the very important syrups that are prevalent. So grape molasses or pekmez, really, really important ingredient. One of our oldest sweeteners in the world. And it's delicious. I've used it in biscuits before. You could use that. Or you could use honey. Honey is so important in Middle Eastern and Eastern Mediterranean and Balkan dishes. Really, really important. Like honey cake. Oh, the best. Yeah, it's also used in a lot of savory food as well. So I thought you could maybe use those. But if you've got like a really nice maple syrup, definitely use it. Or if you've got a nice, you could use carob. That's also a really important one in this region. You could use, what else could you use? You could use agave. I wouldn't use pomegranate molasses. I did think about it, but I tried it and it's way too sour. I tried to sweeten it up as well, but without having to make a full syrup on the stove, it wasn't really working for me. So I would skip that. But grape molasses would be nice. As I say, maybe carob or honey. Okay. And then vanilla is not a traditional ingredient, but it's obviously quite popular in modern times. But it's not, it wasn't used, you know, a long time ago. In these countries because it's from very far away. You could also, or instead, use cinnamon. So I'd use maybe half a teaspoon of cinnamon. You could use maleb, about 2 teaspoons because it's quite mild. That's a common thing in Greece, Cyprus, Turkey, Middle East. Common ingredient. Up to you. And another good serving option, I think, would be, as well as the syrup, be putting some ashta or kaimak on the plate, or its English cousin, which is clotted cream. So this is also a cake that is good the day it's made. It's also good the day after and the day after that. It keeps well at room temperature, but it's, you don't have to do it in advance like the other ones. Okay, so you have the very simple list of ingredients. 250 grams of caster or superfine sugar, or granulated, doesn't really matter, although it might take slightly longer to whip up the eggs, plus a teaspoon for the crumble bit. 300 grams of walnuts, which is about 10 and a half ounces. in case that's useful to know, 3 teaspoons of vanilla sugar or extract. I used vanilla sugar here. 4 UK or EU medium or US, Australia, Canada large eggs, and a couple of pinches of fine salt. So you can also use a pinch of cream of tartar if you like to help stabilize the eggs. So the method is super simple. Preheat your oven to 180°C, 300 Fahrenheit, 160°C fan. Grease and line a 23 centimeter or 8 inch round springform pan. Grind 250 grams of the walnuts into a coarse flour. Don't take it too far because you'll get a nut butter, but you also don't want chunks, you know what I mean? So a coarse flour consistency. Whisk, and then in it's obviously in a separate thing, whisk the eggs, the vanilla, the salt and the sugar and the cream of tartar if you want to add that, to a ribbon consistency. I'm sure you know what that means, but just in case, that's where if you bring the whisk out and you let some of the mixture fall onto the rest of it, it sits on top of the mixture in a ribbon for a couple of seconds before settling in. So once you've whipped your eggs, that will take quite a while, by the way, your eggs and sugar. So you can do other jobs if you're lucky enough to have a stand mixer while that's happening, but just keep a close eye on it at the same time. Then you want to fold in the ground walnuts. Transfer that to the tin and bake it for about 30 minutes. Meanwhile, pulse the remaining 50 grams of walnuts in a food processor a few times to chop them into kind of a large crumb size. It doesn't matter if they're uneven, it's kind of nice actually. And then mix that with a teaspoon of sugar and a teaspoon of vanilla to have you've got your vanilla walnut crumb. After the cake's had 30 minutes, add the walnut crumbs to the top and then return it to the oven. I've done that so they don't just sink in, by the way. Then return it to the oven for 10 to 15 minutes until a skewer inserted into the middle comes out mostly clean. This is quite a sticky cake that sinks a bit and it's kind of like got very delicate crumb, but it's wonderful. It doesn't look the best, but it tastes incredible and the texture is incredible. If your oven burns the tops of things, you might want to add your walnut crumb later, so like 5 minutes before the end of the full bake time. And then leave it to cool completely before slicing, and then serving with the syrup of your choice and a nice drink, maybe a dollop of cream. So that's our walnut, craggly walnut and vanilla cake. It's, as I say, it just looks brown and crumbly, but it tastes amazing. I love walnuts. It tastes like nutty, vanilla-y goodness. It's delicious. It's such a good cake to have with a cup of tea or coffee. It's a good cake to have mid-morning. It's a good cake to have mid-afternoon. It's a good cake to have at lunch. It's a good cake to have as a snack. I love it. It's great. The harissa, the coconut and semolina cake, is addictive. And the hilbert is just so interesting and unusual, but also delicious. So I think I've talked about 3 absolute bangers of cakes. I hope that you try one out. And if not, I hope that I've got you into syrup cakes and that you go off and make another one of your choosing. It's been lovely talking to you. Go and sign up to the newsletter, homebaking.substack.com. That's where you can find recipes as well. And all that's really left for me to tell you is what is coming up next. Okay, so the next episode is going to be ice cream sandwiches. So I'm really excited to get baking and freezing for that episode. A lot of work to do, but I'm really looking forward to it. So I'll see you in a couple of weeks. And then after that, I might talk to you about my travels. So I'm going to Istria in northern Croatia in sort of mid to late August. So I might talk to you about what we ate around and about Istria. And yeah, that's about it from me. So take care and happy baking. Bye bye. My PS for this week is a really good one. It's about peeling strawberries. So I came across the fact that the Spanish chef and restaurateur, Jose Andres, he says he eats his strawberries peeled. He says that it's juicier and more delicious, basically. So I thought, I've got to try this. I've got to get on board and see for myself what difference this makes. So I got a paring knife, I got a strawberry, and I peeled said strawberry by basically you remove the top layer of skin and seeds, and then you're left with the kind of like more fleshy part basically, which is a little bit like eating the texture of an inside of a kiwi. Now, it wasn't much different from just eating a strawberry. And the amount of faff. Can you imagine having to peel lots of strawberries? The amount of faff that would take. So this gets a thumbs down from me. Definitely not worth it. Definitely a waste of time. It doesn't really make much difference to the experience in my opinion. So I don't get it. But if you've tried it and you like it, let me know. I'm curious. All right. See ya.